from St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. Missouri's 2nd Congressional District could end up being quite competitive in the general election, especially if Republicans have a poor showing nationally. Joan Vondras is trying to make the case to Democrats that she's the strongest contender to oust Republican Representative Ann Wagner. Vondras joins us on Politically Speaking to talk about her campaign and to tackle the big issues of the day. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
Let's go back to some of those policies, to that peace and prosperity that we had some 4 to 5 years ago.
Everywhere is Democratic country once this Democrat's been there.
There are a lot of things in Washington that are very bipartisan, including some bills that I've already gotten passed.
And I think it works best when you can see both sides, but you have to pick one, and I firmly align with the Republicans.
But certainly, I think if she's running against one of the crazy dudes, certainly it's going to be a lot easier.
But I'll take wisdom and age and a few missteps in oratory over somebody who has no substance.
I believe that you represent the party's values and you move forward, and that's what I have done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio's politics correspondent, Jason Rosenbaum. Joining us in the studio today, she is one of two major Democratic candidates running in Missouri's 2nd Congressional District. Our guest today is
Joan Vondras.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And before we talk about the campaign and some of the issues in this campaign, I do want to give our listeners a chance to learn more about you and what you were doing before you decided to jump into the wacky and wild world of Missouri politics.
Well, thank you for that, Jason. I have been here my entire life. I had a career of 30 years teaching in the community, connecting with families, improving public education, wrote $250,000 of grants when I was in Parkway. And the last chapter that I published with a friend was In Cycles of Meaning, Empowerment Through Talk, Creating Democratic Communities. So this has always been a thing for me. I've also raising my children here. Well, they're raising their children here, so I'm a grandma as well. Deeply committed to this community.
Why Congress and why the 2nd Congressional District in particular?
One of the things that I loved the most in my career was teaching about the Constitution. As I mentioned earlier, that I always had an eye on education as the foundation for democracy, because it is. And I think there's an opportunity right now to have a teachable moment. My heart is breaking over what is happening to the Constitution and the checks and balances. And this is not the kind of future I want for my grandchildren or my community or my nation. And I can sit and complain about it and be upset, or I can use the skill set that I have to make things better. And that is why I'm stepping into the race, because I do think I'm the right person with the right skill set to fix this.
Why do you think that you are the Democrat that can beat Ann Wagner in November?
Actually, besides being deeply rooted in the community, I have been giving workshops since 2025 on how you bridge the divide, saving democracy one conversation at a time. And I just started running out library room and inviting people in to have those conversations. And I have been working with Republicans, independents, and Democrats on that very thing. And as I have been joining this race for Congress, I have been running as I will represent. I've been doing those same things with my town halls, bringing people together to talk about policy specifically and giving them opportunities to connect. That's what we have to do. People want to be heard. You see it everywhere. That's why they're upset with Ann Wagner right now. That's why you see what's going on in Franklin County. People don't feel heard, or in Festus. People are getting together and realizing that their voice is being diluted and we're losing our representation, our democracy. People want to get it back, and I want to help them do that.
Do you think that Democratic voters in particular want to bridge the divide with Republicans right now?
What I have discovered in all of my conversations is you've got about 70%. The majority of people do not want this. You might have 15% on both sides that you're not going to get through. So when I started doing these workshops, one reason I did it is because I don't believe the idea that social media is giving us, that we're more divided than we really are, because we are not. I in a coffee shop just last week, I had the Republican representative for Braver Angels and another Republican and an independent and a bunch of Democrats. And we sat around with common concern for what is happening to our democracy. There are plenty of people that want to put country above party. And those are the people we need to tap into.
The reason I asked that question is, and I don't know if every Democrat thinks this way, but they're probably seeing what this administration is doing, particularly like on immigration, and they don't want reapproachment with Republicans. They want, for instance, like Stephen Miller to go to jail for what happened to Alex Pretty and Renee Good and all the protesters in Minnesota and for what has happened to people without legal status. Or they want key members of, you know, Donald Trump's administration, you know, literally prosecuted afterwards. And they see Republicans who voted for Donald Trump as part of the reason why we're in this situation right now. Is that not what you're hearing from many Democrats? Do they really want to have a reapproachment with Republicans?
What I am hearing and what I am seeing is an opportunity for people to understand that we cannot fix this problem if we don't fix Congress and the courts. And that's just not me believing that. That's in the book, How Democracies Die. If you just go right at the executive and just start prosecuting everybody, it leaves the moderates out. And we will not win District 2 if we alienate the moderates. But I am also excited to belong to a group called Take Back Congress. They want to bring balance and accountability to Congress. And that is the largest slate of Democrats in history that have joined together. There's over 100 of us. And we are signatories on things we want to get accomplished. Get rid of Citizens United. Get rid of stock trading when you're in Congress. Remove the revolving door. Have a 5-year moratorium so they can't go from Congress to K Street. We want term limits. We also want a code of ethics for the Supreme Court. Those are things we have to do structurally to get things back. The other thing is I want to be on the Problem Solvers Caucus. There are Republicans that actually do care and want to work toward consensus. That group right now is focused on affordability. They're the reason we got the housing bill just a couple weeks ago. They are also the ones that did the infrastructure bill. So as constituents, we need to start putting people into Congress that are not going to be intimidated by Donald Trump. I mean, Ann Wagner has voted with Trump 95% of the time. That is not representation, that's attendance.
We'll talk more about the general election near the end of the show, but I would be remiss if we didn't talk about the Democratic primary. There's another major candidate in the race, Fred Wellman. He was on our show last year after he announced. He has raised a significant amount of money. He has the support of a number of sitting members of Congress, a number of prominent local officials, including Jill Shoup, who ran for the 2nd District in 2020 and got DCCC support. A lot of people are seeing him as the favorite in this race and not you. Do you see it the same way?
No, I see it differently because I was talking to Jill Shoup at the same time and she thought I could win it as well. So did Ray Hartman and some other people. And I decided to have lunch with Fred and I asked him, because he said he would never run. And I was thinking about running and I wanted to know why he felt that way. He told me that he was going to run, he could raise $6 million and he was speaking to the DCCC. So I thought, okay, I'll help support Fred. And I did that for quite a while. But then after a couple of town halls and some repeated things that he was saying, especially about his bankruptcies and how that's making him a better leader, it gave me pause because I don't know that that's going to translate into the District 2 community. And then I started looking deeper. And it reminds me of the child that you have in the classroom that has some problems over here that might have done something wrong and tells you about that. But then you don't look deeply here. You don't look over there. So what I learned over the next few months was that there is a lot more going on that meets the eye. And I do not want to lose this seat. And what I know, Ann knows. When we go to Congress, it's our tax dollars that pay for that. And it's also our role to decide how to spend those tax dollars. I think it's really important to be fiscally responsible and to say, well, all of this has made you a better leader. Well, I've always been involved in leadership, and I didn't need catastrophe to make me a better leader.
Jill Shoup, Cort Van Oster, and Trish Gumby did not have these problems. She still found ways to viciously attack all of them, and they all lost.
Right.
If he didn't have financial problems, it would be something else that she would use. This idea that she's not going to attack you because you don't have financial problems doesn't seem to track with what she's done in the past. So, like, what is isn't she going to find some vulnerability to whoever wins this race and then use her money to amplify it up to 100?
I think she's really going to have to dig pretty deep. I've been here my whole life. I'm sitting here with my high school sweetheart of 46 years, who I've been married to for 38. And I've had a pretty simple life living here, dedicated to this community and to Parkway and to Clayton and to families. So I don't necessarily agree with that. And you know, I know she's going to have a lot of money, but I also think that people are tired of being owned and by big money and having outside money and influence and the establishment decide who their candidates are. People can decide who their candidates are, and we need to get our representative democracy back so they can do so.
All right, let's talk about the issues, because I think that's what people probably want to hear more than just political bickering, although we'll talk about political bickering in the general election at the end of the show. What would you do in Congress to hold the Trump administration accountable, especially if the Democrats retake the House?
Well, we've got to get our authority back and exercise our purview over tariffs, over everything that he has dismantled. We've got to get the ACA credits back and all of that. But regarding Trump, there have got to be investigations. We have got to move forward with those. But we can't let it overshadow the work that people want on affordability right now, because people are hurting financially. So we've got to be able to do two things at once, for sure. And going back there, we've also got to be thinking about what can we do immediately, what can we do short-term, and what we can do long-term. For example, let's take health care. We need to get those short-term, we need to get the ACA subsidies back. I think we also need to look maybe in some way to get some of the medical debt relief, because that is the number one cause of bankruptcy in this country. And we need to focus on Medicare for all. To say there's a public option is a Band-Aid. It's going to be just a way to keep the insurance companies influencing our medical system. And Medicare is our health is a right. It is not a commodity. And that is a big piece with the affordability. And the other thing is looking at universal pre-K, for example. You know, right now, we know that ages 3 through 5, children have the most neuroplasticity at any time in their life. Mm-hmm. Yet we wait for schools to start when they are 5 years old. You have some kids coming in with a vocabulary 400 words. You have some kids coming in with 4,000. That's a gap that never gets made up. So we need to look at that as well. And that would also address the affordability with the outrageous expense of preschool.
How would you pay for Medicare for all?
Well, there's two different programs right now. You've got Sanders and Warren. In Warren's plan, you are pulling some of the money that's being spent on Medicaid and other things like Medigap and such. Well, people pay for Medigap, but Medicaid, and folding that into it as well. I'm reading the book, Medicare for All, A Citizen's Guide, and there are a lot of different ways to finance it. But the thing that sticks out the most with that is that people are paying so much with their copays and their high deductibles that if you are taxed, it will be at a much lower rate than what you are already putting out for your out-of-pocket expenses and all these other things. So the prediction is that it's people over 400,000 that might pay more in tax. And I know that I think Sanders wants a wealth tax to pay for it. Warren does not. But there's still other ways to think about how we fund it and how fast we move to funding it as well. Three of the town halls that I did were on Medicare for All, because that is what constituents said when I did my first three town halls. I asked people, what do you want to talk about? Number one in all three areas, West County, South County, and Franklin County, was health care. So I worked with Ed Weisbart, Physicians for a National Health Plan, and he presented to those three regions. It was a Medicare calculator on my site. You can plug in what you're paying right now, and it will help predict that for you. And it also has some of the ideas on how we fund this. But the bottom line is we can't keep doing what we're doing. We have some of the worst outcomes in the world, and we pay more for our health care than anywhere in the world.
You mentioned tariffs. Would you vote to remove almost all of the Donald Trump tariffs? Or are there some tariffs you think should remain in place? Because it may seem like that's a Republican-Democratic divide, but there are some Democrats that like the concept of tariffs under certain circumstances to protect heavy industry, for instance.
Which That's is right.
Why, which is why you don't see Tammy Duckworth and Dick Durbin as animated about it as Claire McCaskill was. But continue. I didn't mean to
interrupt. We need to look at the unstrategic tariffs. Mm-hmm. You know, they're to be used as a scalpel, not a cudgel. Mm-hmm. So we are going to have to examine the ones that we do need to remove that are hurting the economy and hurting our farmers and hurting our local economy and that are just vengeful tariffs, which he just arbitrarily puts on things. And, you know, Congress, that's in the purview of the Congress. So we need to definitely use them strategically. And you don't just go in and get rid of all the tariffs. That's just silly.
What committees would you want to serve on if you're elected?
I am interested in the Agriculture Committee. You know, we have huge corporations here that are deal with agriculture. But the other thing we have are really precious small farms that need some help. We haven't passed a farm bill since 2018. These skinny bills are not going to do it. We also have SNAP benefits on that as well. And, you know, a nation that can feed itself is a strong and healthy nation. And we can't keep losing our farmland to venture capitalists and foreign countries because we are putting farmers in a position where they have to sell their land.
What is your take on the hot button issue of the day, which is data centers? And obviously, you don't have necessarily the power to stop data centers locally, but it's almost guaranteed that you're going to be dealing with AI policy nationally. And there actually have been proposals to ban states from regulating AI, which would have included data centers. So while this may seem like a issue out of nowhere, this could actually be in your wheelhouse. So what's your thought on them?
I have had two town halls on AI and a digital bill of rights. Mm-hmm. Other countries have a digital bill of rights, and some of the states are getting that together. But there needs to be federal legislation because AI needs to serve humanity. Humanity should not be serving AI. So we do have to look at that. And in regard to the data centers, we're talking about the hyperscale data centers. And it almost seems like there's a gold rush for it. We have like just an incredible number more than even China does. And if you look at regular data centers, there's some good lessons there. Last night, I was at one of the Meet the Candidates in a living room, and a woman was telling me about Epic in Madison, Wisconsin. And granted, they're 3.5, you know, megawatts versus what Beltline wants to do, which is just huge. Mm-hmm. But they are producing their own energy. They are using geothermal. They are using wind and solar. They are capturing the heat and putting them into, you know, like a quarry to hold the heat and also into another type of system, like a couple different systems. So they can access it later. And they're really thoughtful and innovative about how we go about that. We're rushing into this. And my concern is with this gold rush for this, we are going to have unintended consequences. And you think about that right now. Mm-hmm. You know, we are getting a part of the $7 billion for RECA because we live in one of the most poisoned states from that enrichment project. So what's it going to be when we just rush in with these data centers and we don't fully vet the environmental impact and the economic impact? And I've been to multiple meetings in Franklin County, and I have listened to the people as they have spoken so eloquently with their concerns. And it seems like they're finally being heard. Festus definitely got heard.
What about cryptocurrency? There was actually legislation, and I'm as you'll see with this question, I'm not really into cryptocurrency. But I know that there was legislation that basically like regulated or legitimized it. From the outside looking in, this seems like a Ponzi scheme. And a lot of Democrats have frankly fallen into it. Why should cryptocurrency even exist? And why shouldn't we have just a straight up ban on this?
I am with you on that, to be honest. I am. And I think it's a good way to grift, right? And I think that we do need to have really strong conversations about that.
I mean, I don't know what it does. Like, do you know what it does functionally other than you buy it and you hope it makes more money? Like, you can't use it to buy stuff, right?
Right. And
unless it's drugs, like right? Yeah, unless it's drugs. Yeah, continue.
No, you know, we need to, I think, keep with the system we have in the Federal Reserve. And I have not been convinced about crypto yet. So
yeah, I'm surprised somebody hasn't filed a lawsuit and said that cryptocurrency violates the constitutional provision that says you can only have one currency.
Exactly.
So it was odd to me that Congress was regulating a non-currency when we only have one currency. I think people who like crypto can probably see where my perspective is on that issue.
It's another grift.
Before we go to break, one issue that's going to be on the November ballot is whether to institute a near total abortion ban again in Missouri. Mm-hmm. I say near total because this new version of Amendment 3, which is absolutely not the same version of Amendment 3 that legalized abortion, right, would ban most abortions except for medical emergencies, fetal abnormalities, and for a 12-week period, rape and incest. First of all, tell me what you think of that initiative, and then if you could provide a more general sense of what your position on abortion rights are.
Oh, I think that is an absolutely ridiculous thing to do. We've got to protect women's rights. You know, we have some of the highest mortality rates for women and children in this country, especially among minorities. And, you know, I think about my own experience, and I don't want to make it about me, but I'm adopted. And in that situation, my mother was offered an abortion. Now, this was in the 60s when it was illegal. Mm-hmm. And what I will tell you is people of means will still find a way, and all it will do is harm our most vulnerable populations. So that, you know, it is health care, right? It is health care. And 67%, I think, of District 2 voted for Amendment 3 the first time and understand that is health care.
Your website said you want to codify Roe versus Wade. Mm-hmm. So that would mean that you would want to pass federal legislation that legalizes abortion up to,
yes,
like, I was about to say fetal abnormalities, but fetal viability, which is around 24, 26 weeks of pregnancy. Is that basically what your position is?
I think that is a good starting point for conversation. I do. And I think that, you know, basically it's between the doctor and the woman. And, you know, one of the things that really illuminated things for me is I went to the Ethical Society one time and listened to a panel of women who were in their third trimester, and they had to have an abortion.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to. They had their nursery set up. The one woman was literally hanging upside down to try to keep that baby in her. And, you know, there are other women that they've got to make a choice. They've got other children, and having this baby might kill her. You know, I know someone who ended up having to keep that baby inside her and went septic. So it's got to be between the doctor and the patient.
I should have added, with it, when you go beyond fetal viability, there would be exceptions.
If yes,
the baby,
yes.
The baby is like basically dead,
right,
or the mother is going to die.
Right.
Not at 9 months of pregnancy.
Yes.
At 9 months of pregnancy, they would just induce the pregnancy, deliver
right,
the baby,
exactly,
and save the mother's
yes,
life.
Yes.
I want to make it clear that's
okay,
not what I'm asking you.
Okay.
Because that often, I mean, Ann Wagner is going to say that you're for abortion at 9 months of pregnancy. She did that with Trish Gunby.
Right.
But I
right,
think we got to be very specific when we talk about what
yeah,
should
yeah,
or shouldn't
right,
be legal.
You're right.
But so that was my fault. Don't worry
okay,
about that.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll be right back
okay,
with Politically Speaking with Joan Von Gross. And we're back on Politically Speaking with Joan Von Gross. She is a Democratic candidate for the 2nd Congressional District. I want to move to foreign policy. Iran war, if you had been in Congress, would you have voted for War Powers Resolution restricting Donald Trump from attacking Iran?
Absolutely.
And why?
Because that's the purview of Congress.
Yeah. Did you
it's a check.
You thought it was a bad thing for him to attack Iran, I imagine. Right?
Absolutely.
Can you explain why?
$1 trillion?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we you know, Obama, he just wants to break things so he can get the credit for fixing them. And, you know, Obama, we had the nuclear deal, and it was working. And he undid it. And now we're in a worse situation than we were before. We don't even have access to Strait of Hormuz. I was talking to my cousin, who is a farmer in Arkansas, and you know, you just think of the price of urea, which is usually $300 a ton. Now it's $1,000 a ton. Now, people are hurting here because of those decisions, and also people are hurting worldwide. I was reading where some of the countries are in a COVID level situation as far as supply. So it's a big mess. And he went into it without our allies, and he just is not a team player. And you cannot move about in this world that is so interconnected with just irrational decisions.
Would you want to do a similar thing that the Obama administration did and try to negotiate with Iran to try and make it less likely they'll produce a nuclear weapon?
I think diplomacy is always what is best. And hopefully the genie's not out of the bottle too much. I don't have that information right now because I'm not in Congress, but I am curious to just, you know, how much of the genie is out of the bottle at this point.
I'm going to make the same joke that I made with the six district candidates. Are you serious that Donald Trump is not telling you about Iran war plans right now? That's so inconsiderate of him. He should be giving all candidates insight into that.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking
I'm being facetious. Okay. I'm making fun of myself. Okay. I want to make clear I'm not making fun of you. Okay. I made the same joke with the other people. If you look at the first district Democratic primary, one of the things that has been a big dividing line over the last two election cycles is the Israeli-Palestinian mm-hmm. conflict. It's not as been as much in the second district. It does seem like the Democratic candidate and Ann Wagner have had pretty similar views in favor, more favorable to Israel. But it does seem to me that a lot has changed in the last 2 to 4 years, where Democratic voters in particular have really soured on the United States' alliance with Israel. And they're not only concerned, they are outraged and alarmed about what Israel has been doing in Gaza, the West Bank, Lebanon, and elsewhere. I'm not saying that you as a member of Congress will be able to solve this, but I'm interested to hear if, for instance, you have to vote on sending weapons to Israel or vote on sending, I don't know, weapons or aid to Gaza or the West Bank. What's going to be your mentality as a member of Congress?
Well, first, I think we need to work on a two-state solution and diplomacy. And I think the reason people are upset about that money going to Israel is Israel is using that money to commit, you know, South Africa's, you know, having us looked at for war crimes. And then you've got the UN, which had a committee that looked at genocide, and it came up with that they have met 4 out of 5. That's our taxpayer dollars that are going toward that. And Americans are not happy about that. Netanyahu's just doing whatever he wants with the money. There's no check on Netanyahu. And certainly, if we are sending our tax dollars over to foreign countries, we should have some weight on how that money is being used.
So we're recording this on July 17th. There was a vote that ostensibly was trying to remove money for Israel, although Emmanuel Cleaver points out that it was written so broadly that it really wouldn't have actually stopped any money from going to Israel. So let's not talk about that specific vote. At this point, would you be a yes or a no on cutting off military aid to Israel?
To be honest with you, I do not know enough about what has already been sent and how much they're talking about sending right now and enough about the situation. But I do think that we need to really examine how much they have right now and also what we can do to rebuild Gaza. So I really just don't feel that I can weigh in on that right now in an educated way.
One of the other things that often gets put up for votes in Congress, even though it seems like a state issue, is curtailing gender-affirming care for minors. Like, I think Congress, especially the House, has voted on it like 70 times now. I've asked Fred Wellman about this, and he said that he doesn't like the fact that Republicans are basically bullying trans kids. I would like to ask the same question to you. What would be your posture if you have to vote on whether to ban gender-affirming care for minors?
I have worked with children who have been in that position. Mm-hmm. And I remember one in particular, and she came back as a he and when he was 20. And he was so happy. And you could just see that he felt that he had fulfilled who he needed to be. And I also know other people that are trans, and they are living a great life, and they are contributing to the community, and they're not causing harm to anyone. And we also know that the suicide rates are very high in the LGBTQ community, especially with transgender. And I just think with all of the things that we are facing and that we are solving, that this is just a shiny object to divide us, and it's causing harm to a vulnerable community.
You mentioned affordability a couple of times. One of the ideas that's been brought up primarily by Republicans, I think that even Josh Hawley brought this up, is to suspend the gas tax while gas prices are really high. That didn't really get a very warm reception even among Republicans, because that would basically cut off funding for federal transportation projects. First of all, before I ask my next question, what's your thought about that idea of suspending the gas tax until the gas prices go down?
Well, I think we need to really look at our taxation, and we need to get a progressive tax code back. I mean, you know, look at the $80 trillion that's been taken out of this economy, especially after, you know, Reagan and his whole trickle-down thing. It's gone up to the 1%. And you've got Kehoe talking about this ridiculous removal of income tax, which makes up two-thirds of our state budget. How about we get prices down? How about we start making things more affordable? How about we help our farmers and we start, you know, investing in public schools and keeping our public tax dollars in public schools and creating opportunity through education and improving our communities? So, you know, we fight over the tax here, tax there. The fact of the matter is we've got to examine this tax code and we've got to close some of these loopholes because we've got the money. It's just all sitting in the 1%.
Do you think that maybe getting rid of the tariffs could deal with the affordability problems in this country? Because if you got rid of the tariffs, then the people that are importing goods wouldn't be passing them along to consumers.
Oh, yeah. I think some of those tariffs, the ones that, that Trump put in, definitely. But it's going to take a while to get those prices back down because, you know, he's also, you know, pretty much messed up the supply chain. So we've got... And, you know, you think about what the, you know, the 40, was it 40 billion he sent to Argentina and our soybeans or people are buying their soybeans elsewhere. It's going to take a lot to rebuild this and the damage that he's caused. But we've got to do it. And one way to do it is really have a comprehensive farm bill.
All right. As promised, I want to talk about your general election strategy. And I'll say the same thing as I did on the Wellman podcast. If the new map is in effect, so the 2025 map, not the 2022 map, I don't really think there's I don't want to say there's no difference. I think it's several points more Republican, but not really enough to withstand a Democratic wave election. I think she could lose either way. That's my feeling.
I
assume
agree.
You agree, too.
I agree. Yes.
Yeah. What is going to be your strategy to beat her? And I understand that there's a lot of Democrats that live in the 2nd District, and a lot of Democrats really dislike Ann Wagner. But the fact remains that every Democrat that's run against her has lost in St. Louis County, which has gotten significantly more Democratic, and has not come close to closing the margins in the other counties. What's going to be your strategy to do something different than the candidates that have lost?
I have been criticized for my strategy by Democrats, but we need to realize that the majority of people in District 2 there are more independents than there are Democrats. And we've got to get out of our silos, which has been my work since January of 2025, and I'm doing it right now, trying to bridge the divide. We have got to have conversations with Republicans and independents. We've got to get the town hall back. I am in living rooms every night or every day. I am in either a living room, I'm at a library, I'm having a town hall, I'm making myself accessible, and I actually enjoy having the conversations. We have to find common ground, and right now, the common ground is that we're losing our representative democracy. And there are people that are genuinely concerned because people are feeling the trauma. And people learn from traumatic events. So what I'm finding is they're more open to even Democratic policies. I went into a coffee shop in St. Clair a couple weeks ago, and everybody in that coffee shop was not a Democrat, let me tell you. But I sat there and had conversations, and I listened, and every person I spoke to was open to Medicare for All and universal pre-K. People are starting to see a need for those. They're experiencing themselves. So they're open to those ideas. And we need to be calling people in, not calling people out.
One of the biggest changes between the old and the new map is you basically traded territory in St. Charles County for territory in Jefferson County. Now, I've spent a lot of time talking about how I think Democrats are getting very well organized in St. Charles County to the point where they might win several state legislative seats. It has gone in the way opposite direction in Jefferson County in the last 10, 15 years, where everybody in Jefferson County is Republican who's elected. But I also look at what happened in 2024, where Amendment 3 to legalize abortion only lost by like 3 or 4 points in Jefferson County. So when you go to Jefferson County, what are you feeling there in terms of enthusiasm for a Democrat after that part of the state used to be Democratic, then became competitive, then went toward Republicans.
What I'm finding is people just want to have conversations, and they come to the coffee shops, or they have me in their living rooms. But the other thing I'm doing with this town halls, and I did this even before I started running, is I am partnering with people that are running as state representatives, like Meredith Sumanik. Mm-hmm. Who is just fantastic. Or let's take Fenton, you know, Jen Trickey. She did the AI town hall with me, and we're pulling people in. And I think it's really important to have a partnership with the state and the federal candidates. And that's been really appealing to people in Jefferson County or any of the counties when they see that we are a team and that we are communicating and we are working together, because our representation at the state level is at the same risk as it is at the federal level. So I think it's an opportunity right now to really reach those independent voters.
What message do you have to national Democrats to tell them that the second district is worth putting on their radar? Because it is on their radar. Like, even after the redistricting, I'm still getting messages from like DCCC and adjacent groups talking about how bad Ann Wagner is. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they've completely taken it off the board, but we have seen it taken off the board in elections where they don't feel that the candidate is strong enough or they haven't raised enough money. And I said this on Donnybrook yesterday, having like DCCC funding is a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing because you have money. It's a curse because they force you into a very bland box as a candidate. Just ask Jill Shoup about that or any other. But the reality is you need national support sometimes to win. So why should national Democrats pay attention to the second district?
You know, I think of a couple things. When I got into this race, there was an article in the New York Times that said the problem with the DNC is they focus on the candidate that can raise the most money rather than the one that is connected to the community. And that is exactly what I've experienced with the DNC. The second thing just was 2 weeks ago with all that Plattner stuff. They talked about how the establishment gets behind the candidate that has the biggest personality rather than the candidate of purpose. So I do feel that people are smarter here in District 2. And I think that if we can get a candidate with purpose that is connected to the community, that really wants to bring back civil discourse in the public square, I think it appeals largely to people in this district. And we need to get back to local representation, and we need to move away from the influence of these nationalized elections. And people are starting to see that, too.
Do you think that's really possible not to have the influence of national parties if you're talking about a race for Congress, though?
I think we can have the influence of the national parties, but I think we need to get rid of Citizens United so we can get back to the local funding of elections and get to ranked choice voting. And maybe we take a look at federally funded elections. We've got to clean this up. Big money is diluting our representation.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And for all of our stories, go to stlpr.org. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is a part of the University of Missouri system. And Joan, how could people find out more about you and your campaign on the World Wide Web?
Go to votejoan.com. I have events everywhere. Please come and see me because I want to listen to you and you will be heard. And I also want you to know that I would not be in this race coming out of retirement if I didn't believe that there was hope in this moment.
Thank you very much. Until next time, so long. Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio, this is Politically Speaking.